Hey, this is Jonathan Goodman, and I have incredibly exciting news. My book, The Obvious Choice, is now available for purchase in Kindle, in Audible, and in hardcover. Anywhere that you find books, please go on Amazon, please go to whatever bookstore you like, buy yourself a copy, buy a copy for a friend. Hope that you absolutely love it. Now let's get into the show. I learned that the rewards you get from the outcome of any finished project are never as great as the rewards you get from the project itself. No amount of praise, prestige, or profit after the fact replaces the internal growth when you're stuck in the messy middle of something. It's okay to be driven by projects, good even, so much so that the worst thing that can happen is that you don't have one bearing down on you. I got out of the funk by getting back to work. Welcome back to the Obvious Choice podcast. It has been a weird few weeks since the Obvious Choice book has come out. And I want to talk about why, because for really the first time I can ever remember, I found myself like sad, almost depressed. I think this is what feeling depressed kind of feels like. I've never felt it before, to the best of my knowledge, but I thought it'd be good to talk about. So that's what we're going to talk about today. Let's start with this parable about the Portuguese fisherman. You've probably heard this parable before. It goes like this. The fisherman's boat had several large fresh fish in it. An American investment banker on vacation saw him. He asked the fisherman how long his catch took him. Only a little while, the Portuguese man replied. I have more than enough to support my family. The American then replied what he did with the rest of his time. To which the fisherman said, I sleep late, fish a little, play with my children, take a siesta with my wife, and stroll into the village each evening where I sip wine and play guitar with my friends. You should buy a bigger boat, the American said. Then you'll make more money and be able to afford a fleet of boats, and eventually you'll be able to move to the big city and open your own cannery. The fisherman asked how long this would take. 15 to 20 years, said the American. Then what? Asked the fisherman. Then you will be rich and you can retire. And what would I do then? The fisherman asked. Then, my friend, you will have no worries. You could move to a small coastal fishing village where you would sleep late, play a little, fish, take a siesta with your wife, and stroll to the village in the evenings where you could sip wine and play your guitar with your friends, said the American. Enjoy the process is advice we hear all of the time. Do the verb in order to become the noun, they say, relish the experience, savor the journey, cherish the adventure, you're told. And all of that, I think, is very good in theory. Without application, though, it's useless. The problem that I have with a lot of the conventional self-help, it's like, yeah, that sounds good. I get it. I buy into it. Okay, what the hell do I actually do then? Dot, dot, dot. The book ends. So first, some helpful terminology. Then a new spin on an old story. In linguistics, there's two types of activities. There's telic and atelic activities. Telic activities aim at terminal states. Getting married is telic. It's done when you wed. Writing a book is telic. It's done when your phalange fingers the final key. Driving somewhere is telic. It's done when you arrive. Ren, I know how much you like phalanging the final key.
Phalange is his finger. Yeah, this is my favorite.
Atelic activities don't aim at terminal state. It doesn't drive towards finishing, it describes the process, which never completes. The same activity done differently can be either telic or atelic. For example, walking home is telic. Home is the end state. Going for an aimless walk, on the other hand, is atelic. It's true that you will eventually stop walking, but aimless walks are never actually completed. That's why the two activities feel so different from one another. In our future-focused society, we're trained to be telic. Always striving to get there, never here, thinking about the past, striving toward the future while leaving the present curiously unoccupied. So I live in a small Mexican fishing village most winters. I'm here right now. One morning at the gym, I met Isaac. He's a Mexican-American. He was born in town. He went to college in California, got some finance degree, then came back. Isaac works out every morning with his girlfriend and dog. At sunset, you'll find him playing spike ball on the beach with friends. During the day, he works at the best taco spot in town. And you know, I've never seen Isaac without a smile. He's fit, he eats fresh fruit, gets free tacos, he's surrounded by people that he loves. But a part of me also knows that I wouldn't be able to do what he does, and I also wonder how long he'll be able to do it. Because it's too perfect.
Idyllic days on repeat where the sun shines, the food's delicious, and the activities are great are nice in theory. Without contrast, however, desensitization sets in and it leads to burnout just the same. And so I'm left with a paradox, call it the false allure of early retirement, of giving the middle finger to the real world and replacing it with beautifully perfect days on repeat. The problem with the Portuguese fisherman story. You see, on one hand, a project-driven life is no way to live, but there's also no way to live other than to be driven by projects. We obviously shouldn't wait to retire to buy a sailboat and sail around the world, because maybe we won't ever be able to afford it, or maybe something tragic will happen and we'll die, or maybe we'll finally make it to those golden years and buy a sailboat only to discover that sailing sucks, or that golf becomes horrendously boring when you do it more than 3 times a year. Actually, golf is always horrendously boring. Golf is a ridiculously stupid sport. But here's my challenge. I want to fall in love with the process and ignore the outcome, but I can't. I just can't. I'm always thinking about the outcome. You want to know what I was thinking about at 11:25 a.m. on October 28th, 2024, as I typed these words for the first time? I was thinking, will my next book that I wrote this section for be a success? Will it sell? Will anybody care? You see, I once produced 3 books, and I say produced because even though my name is on them, I didn't write them. And the books made some money, not a lot, enough to be a good business decision, though. But I learned nothing from the experience. I gained nothing from the experience. So now I don't care about the books enough to even display them on my shelf. They mean nothing to me. They did nothing for me. Purely telic. A strategic business decision. A means to an end. And don't get me wrong, people enjoy those books. That's the Wealthy Fit Pro series. There was Getting Started, the online training one, and the Getting Clients one. In fact, I sent this piece of writing that I'm reading to you out as an email. And I actually had multiple people respond to me about that book set, talking about how much it helped them and how much they enjoyed those books. So this is not a comment on the quality of those books. This is more a comment on what I gained personally from those books as the person whose name is on the front. We had plans to do at least 5 books in that series. And after 3, I said enough was enough. And I thanked the talented ghostwriter, I paid him a severance. Then I swore that it was going to be the last time that I ever did the work for the money, because even though I did get some money, I got nothing from the work. Writing my next book, on the other hand, which will be called The Obvious Challenge, has helped me become more of the father, of the husband, friend, spouse, and boss that I want to be. It's about intentional life design. I'm writing about being more happy and grateful and adventurous. I'm reading and listening and thinking about those things constantly throughout the day. As a result, this work has changed me. It's already helped me to become more of the human that I want to be. You see, the week after I handed in the first draft of my next book, my previous one called The Obvious Choice got released. That just happened. That's what happened 2 weeks ago. The Obvious Choice got released. Well, what you might not know is that the week before that, I handed in the first draft of my next book. The Obvious Choice sold well out of the gate. Didn't make the New York Times list as a bestseller, but it actually sold more than all of the books that did make the list past the 6th spot. Based off of sales alone, The Obvious Choice should have been number 7 on the New York Times bestseller list. The list, of course, is editorialized. I'm a first-time traditionally published author. And so I didn't make it. And so it happens. Whatever. I didn't expect to make it. It is what it is. Choice was also met with critical acclaim. You should see my email. There's tons of incredibly positive reviews. The amount of people that have already told me 2 weeks after the book has come out that they've already read the book and bought multiple copies to gift to other people, their colleagues, their bosses, their team members, is astounding. Seth Godin said, you know, it's the author's job to sell the first 10,000 copies of the book. It's the book's job to sell the next million. Well, I've done the author's job. The book has sold the first 10,000 plus copies. And it seems like the book is going to do its job too. But do you want to know what's been weird about these past 2 weeks? I felt sad. Like, I never feel sad. But for the first time in my life, I felt sad, like I didn't want to get out of bed. That no matter how much accounting I did of everything good going on in my life, it didn't matter. I'm living in Mexico. There's music and tacos and people that I love around. And lots of people were saying nice things to me the last 2 weeks. Lots of people were saying nice things about me the last 2 weeks. Despite that, my world felt gray. I lost my appetite. I went for 3 days without eating anything. I was exhausted. I didn't get out of bed. I had a short temper with my kids. Every day was a malaise. Allison even took me to the medical clinic. Yo, I have not been to the doctor in 10 years. I went for a checkup. That's not true. I went for a checkup, a regular checkup, because Allison was like, get basic blood markers. I went for a checkup 2 years ago, and the doctor checked me out and did basic blood markers and was like, yo, you're good. But Allison took me to the medical clinic, and the doc checked me head to toe, and they didn't find anything. That's because I wasn't sick, at least not in the traditional sense. I think what happened was that for 3 years, I worked on The Obvious Choice. Then the first physical copy arrived, and I held it. Then a release day came, and people bought it. And there was nothing more for me to do. The job was finished. Allison organized a party the night of the release. She invited our friends. She even had Spanish guitar music, my favorite music, playing in the background. She got a cake made with a picture of the book on it. And all of the time I should have been soaking in the celebration and the praise, happy and proud, I felt neither of those things. Instead, I felt an emptiness, like that's it. So here's what I learned from that experience. I learned that the rewards you get from the outcome of any finished project are never as great as the rewards you get from the project itself. No amount of praise, prestige, or profit after the fact replaces the internal growth when you're stuck in the messy middle of something. It's okay to be driven by projects, good even, so much so that the worst thing that can happen is that you don't have one bearing down on you. I got out of the funk by getting back to work. The obvious choice is now something I did, not something that I'm doing. And so on to the next one. The smartest thing that I did when I handed in the final manuscript for Choice last year was start the next book. And the smartest thing I could do when I finish the one that I'm working on right now is to start the one after that. You see, when you find the right project to work on, the worst thing that can happen is that you finish it. And the first thing you should do when that happens is start the next. And maybe that's not healthy. Maybe it's better to rest on your laurels for a bit, to soak it in, to rest, to recharge. But I found that the body is like a car battery. It needs constant movement to stay energized. Doing work that matters is challenging. Work that matters to you, not others. That's the only litmus test that matters. Work that makes you better while you're doing the work, not for it being done. If you cannot explore with your work, no matter how big or important your work is or how much money it makes you, you will burn out and it will feel empty. If you've
listened this far into the podcast, I want to invite you to buy a copy of my new book, The Obvious Choice. It's available now. A lot of people have been asking me what the book's about. The central premise is that it's learning how to position yourself as the clear and trusted answer to a specific group's problems. You see, a lot of people these days are trying to become famous to the faceless, anonymous internet, instead of becoming the obvious choice to a smaller amount of people who are going to buy from you. It's actually much better, much more profitable, much easier, and much faster, and much less stressful to be obviously perfect to a smaller amount of people than just okay to a lot of people who are never going to buy you. You see, you don't need to be the best at everything or chase the largest audience. You need to become the most relevant to your people. What I do is I emphasize the importance of understanding your audience's needs, meeting them where they already are, and delivering such value that choosing anyone else feels irrational. And so pick up a copy of the book. It's in Kindle, it's in Audible, it's in hardcover, wherever you find books. Hope that you absolutely love it.
Finish your work and have nothing else to challenge you, no matter how big or important it is, or how much money it makes you, you will burn out and it will feel empty. You've got to find the atelic within the telic. Waking up each day in the same bed, to the same perfect weather, with the same routine, with no stress, with no challenging project, forcing you to figure some shit out. It's a miserably empty existence. You need the work. I used to love the parable of the Portuguese fisherman. But then I took on the task of writing this book, which forced me to think deeper about the story. And that's when I thought back to Isaac. And the lesson he taught me was that the parable of the Portuguese fisherman is nonsense. And maybe, I don't know, just maybe, the American businessman isn't as crazy as he's made to appear.
You see this happen all the time in sports.
What's that?
Particularly football. The thrill of the ascension and the disappointment in the apex, right? I've heard so many Super Bowl winning quarterbacks, so many NBA championship winning point guards, and you know, and they'll say, the interviewer will say, "Well, you got to the championship and you won the Super Bowl trophy. What was that like?" "Well, honestly, I thought it would have been more exciting. You know, yeah. I thought I would have loved it more, but it just, you know, for some reason, it just didn't fill me up the way that I thought it would."
Right.
And I think it speaks to, I think it speaks to the universal truth of different personality types. I think more people need to be engaged in doing something, building something, attaining something than they probably realize. I do believe that there's a few humans on the planet, like the fishermen, who don't need a project. But I think for most of us, it's human nature to be forward-thinking and goal-seeking in some way. Whether it's writing a book, whether it's finishing a quilt, whether it's getting to the last page of a coloring book, we kind of all need a project to connect to our own humanity. And when we don't have that, I think existence can seem sort of vacuous. I think that's when you get into the existential angst of who am I? Why am I here? What does it all mean? But when I found personally, when I'm doing things, I don't have that existential angst. I've often said that the worst thing that could ever happen in my life was to become like a $60 billion sheik, oil
born
prince.
Into it.
And just never want for anything.
Yeah.
Like, that would be the worst. To not ever have anything that I could not attain, I think that would make life awful really fast.
But you
I don't
would
know
still
what
have want for something. I knew the guy who was the private physiotherapist for one of the richest men in the world. Mm-hmm. I think depending on when you looked at, like, the Forbes list, he was, like, number 10, number 11, number 12. And he was like, a Saudi Arabian oil guy. Right. So this person, my friend, his name's Jonathan, basically got recruited to, like, stretch him once a week and be part of his entourage. And every time that they would come through Toronto, because this guy would have business in Toronto, every time that they come to Toronto, you know, he would rent, he'd bring his three private jets with his whole entourage with him, and he'd rent the top two floors of the Four Seasons. And we'd get together, me and this other guy. One of the things he told me one of the days is, he's like, "I don't think I've ever met a human being that's more miserable in their day-to-day existence." He says, "This guy is so obsessive over his ranking on the Forbes list."
Mm-hmm.
He's so obsessive with the comparison, popularity comparison. This person was spending millions upon millions upon millions of dollars at that time into his Twitter and LinkedIn followings. Because how do you show you're better than other rich guys, right? You get these signs of, and so where does it end? I think is part of it, and you don't really have any real project. But then I look at, or I think about retired people, and one of the examples is my mother-in-law. We call her Pawpaw, Allison's mom. And, you know, she lives in the next town over in Mexico, so we spend a fair bit of time with her in Toronto, the same thing. And it's Chinese New Year tomorrow. You know, what do you do when you're retired, right? Do you just, like, sit and, like, play nine holes of golf and then drink margaritas? Like, I don't know. Sounds pretty miserable. Mostly because golf sucks, but also sounds pretty miserable. Golf is such a – it's like, hey, how can we use a tremendous amount of natural resources and lock off parks from the general public so that a few rich people can hit a ball with a stick? It's like, come on, man. I think all golf courses should be public and not golf courses anymore. But I digress. What do you do when you are tired? It's Chinese New Year's tomorrow. Allison's mom has been spending, like, the last month basically preparing, like, a Chinese New Year's dinner. It's a project. It's something to really push towards. It's a special thing that she's going to take a lot of pride in. There's a Chinese restaurant here in town in Sayulita, and it's this, like, cafeteria-style place. And the guy who runs it doesn't really speak any English, speaks like broken Spanish, but speaks Cantonese. And Allison's mom is basically the only other Cantonese speaker in town. And so they've become friends over the years. Mm-hmm. This guy is cooking, like this guy actually sourced a lot of traditional Chinese foods and vegetables for her. He's actually cooking some of it and like semi-catering a meal for tomorrow. It's been like a real project. They get together. Allison does crafts with all of these ladies every Monday. And they're all retired, other than Allison, of course. And the last 3 weeks, you know what they've been doing? They've been making dumplings by hand. That's their crafting. What a beautiful thing to have a project that is an excuse for you to learn a new skill. That's an excuse for you to get together with other people. What a beautiful thing. You know, it doesn't have to be a project driven by money, of course. But it should be something. There's a section in this next book, The Obvious Challenge, that's called Boring Not Vacant. And how it's okay to be boring, but it's not okay to be vacant. You know, if by boring you walk the dusty stacks at old books and you spend a lot of time finding age-old biographies, or you go to antique car auctions and never bid or buy anything, or you collect salt and pepper shakers, or you are practicing and learning Klingon, or trying and competing to become the World Wizard of Oz champion. You know, that's okay if you do those things. It might be boring to others, but it's not boring to you. I think it's a wonderful thing to find your boring. But it's not okay to be vacant. It's not okay to have nothing that drives you. It's not okay to sit and scroll all day without anything that is absorbing you. Boring, you know, not vacant.
I'm frightened of people that don't do anything at all, ever, for any reason. 'Cause I don't get it. Like is that me?
It's me.
Okay. As long as it's not me, I don't give a shit anymore now. But I have a friend.
I'm in Mexico. All they do is drill through concrete here, no matter where.
That makes sense.
All they do is drill through concrete.
I love it. Gotta earn the margaritas. I've got a friend who is not working, has not worked for consecutive years. I don't know how this happens. But also has no discernible hobby or project that they ever work on, and kind of just sort of watches Netflix like all day, and it's a lady, a friend of a friend actually, and I don't know how she does it. Like I'm personally affected, if not offended, by the entirety of her lifestyle choices. Like I can't understand your existence passing by and just not doing anything at all. Like just nothing. But it seems to be the way she's chosen to live. I'm just very concerned about
if she's happy. Then that's wonderful. I mean, maybe her thing, like I have a good friend, a friend that I grew up with. And I just realized, by the way, that I actually don't have my mic selected. So I'm sorry if the audio is not as good as it normally is here.
Pretty good.
Because I can't switch it in between. But I have a friend who, and I'm going to end with this. I want to make this a short episode. I have a friend who watches a lot of movies. A lot of movies. A lot of movies. Like he works, you know, as kind of this like mid-range employee at a bank. He'll get his promotions, but like that's his life, right? He he's never been driven that much for that kind of conventional success. He does fine. And you'll get his promotions and you'll live his life and you'll go to work and you'll come home at 4 or 5 p.m. And, you know, his wife's a nurse and that's their life. And then he basically watches movies. But you know what he did? He started a podcast with a friend about movies, about obscure movie trivia. And their podcast now has a sponsor. And they don't make a lot of money with the podcast, but they make a few dollars and they have listeners. I think that's wonderful. It's a way for him to connect with a buddy. It's a way for him to have projects and a reason for what he's doing. And you know what? He's making a bit of money with it too. That's cool as shit. When he first started telling me about it, we get together every year. All of my best friends from high school, we call a Chrismica dinner every year. And I miss it sometimes because I'm away and I always miss it. But we've done it now for almost 20 years. I think it was year 19 this year. And so all of us friends have, of course, evolved a fair bit. And some of my friends are now in pretty senior positions in their industries. It's wow, you're actually you were pretty dumb shit back in the day, but you're actually pretty important right now, you know? You were the guy who I had cake parties back in the day with, and we put a keg in a garbage can, and then it would expand, and then we couldn't get the keg out of the garbage can, and so we had to cut the garbage can with hedge trimmers, and then our parents would get home, and they'd say, "What happened to the garbage can?" And we'd say, "Oh, I don't know. Maybe a car hit it," not figuring out that our parents aren't stupid. That's the person now that is very senior in their industry. And it's pretty cool to watch people progress. And this is a guy who has not progressed that way. But, you know, he's figured out his own way. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a beautiful thing. And I think that it's a beautiful project that he has, which is super cool. Anyway, let's cut it here. I wanted this to be a short episode. Thanks for listening. Appreciate you guys.
Okay, bye.
Okay, bye.